This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran condemns the use of unilateral sanctions as political leverage in relations between countries, saying they are a major obstacle to global humanitarian activity. Reaffirming support for Israel, the U.S. opposes Al Jazeera taking the killing of its journalists by Israeli forces to the International Criminal Court. And a new report says Canada has wasted billions of dollars on unused COVID vaccines and pandemic aid to people who are not eligible to receive it. Hello everyone, and thanks for tuning in to World News. Our top story: Iran has once again condemned the imposition of unilateral sanctions by some countries against others as political leverage in bilateral relations between states. Iran's deputy ambassador to the UN made the remark while addressing a General Assembly meeting on humanitarian aid. She described unilateral sanctions as a major obstacle to international humanitarian efforts. The Iranian diplomat added, "Such sanctions are also a breeding ground for all kinds of human crises across the globe." She also voiced Iran's concern about the deviation of humanitarian aid as well as non-humanitarian activities undertaken under the guise of humanitarian aid. Iran says it's dismantled a number of operational cells affiliated with MKO terrorist organization. In a statement, the intelligence ministry said the cells of saboteurs were smashed in the provinces of Tehran, Isfahan, and Kurdistan. Said the elements of those cells were arrested, adding they were involved in terrorist activities and mortar attacks on Iran's administrative, military, police, and residential centers. Ministry said those terror activities caused damage and insecurity to the country, noting all those cells were directly guided by European base of the MKO terror group located out of Albania. The intelligence ministry also reported the confiscation of weapons and equipment used by the terrorists. Iran says recent riots in the country were fomented through foreign interference and represent a hybrid war against the Iranian people. Now, Western countries, the U.S. in particular, are trying to pressure Tehran by using human rights as pretext for removing Iran from the U.N. Commission on the Status of Women. Tehran has slammed the move, calling it illegitimate.
Tehran has slammed Washington's move to push a draft resolution aimed to remove Iran from the UN's Commission on the Status of Women. Iran's foreign ministry says any misuse of the internal developments in Iran to exert political pressure on the country is condemned and unacceptable. Iran has just started a four-year term on the body after a recent voting session by the UN Economic and Social Council. Tehran has repeatedly warned that some Western countries are exploiting human rights for their own political ends. In recent weeks, rioters went on the rampage across the country, brutally attacking security officers and causing massive damage to public property as Western powers, especially the United States, provided support. The European Union and some Western countries have imposed sanctions on Iran over its approach toward the riots. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani said that the U.S. and certain European countries are behind the political and illegal draft resolution and that they are seeking to exert pressure on independent countries to pass it. He said the U.S. move is an action against the free vote of countries in international organizations and structures and questions the legality of such mechanisms in international bodies. He added, there are member countries of the UN Security Council or the Human Rights Council and Human Rights Assemblies that committed countless crimes against governments and independent nations throughout their history and now use human rights tools to exert pressure. Iran has lashed out at Western officials for cheering rioters in independent states while suppressing peaceful protesters in their own countries. Iran's foreign ministry says countries that have coups, conspiracies, interventions and devastating wars with millions of deaths in their history are now pretending to be defenders of human rights in other countries. The best example would be Western countries' hypocritical behavior vis-a-vis protests in Iran and their own states. Western officials say the protests in Britain, Germany, France, Canada, and Australia are bad and deserve severe confrontation, but riots in their targeted countries are good and deserve support.
Now, Iranian officials have criticized the U.S. over its push to remove Iran from the U.N. Commission on the Status of Women, saying that they're acting dictatorially under the name of women's rights. Tehran has vowed to use all of its political and diplomatic capacities to prevent that move.
The riots in Iran began after the death of a young woman named Mahsa Amini in September. She collapsed at a police station in Tehran and later died at a hospital. Since then, the issue of women's rights suddenly caught the imagination of the world. The self-proclaimed human rights champions in the West who turn a blind eye to gross human rights abuses in the US and Europe are accusing Iranian authorities of killing the woman, even though all evidence, including the forensic report, scoffs at those claims. The Islamic Republic has strongly censured several countries for provoking riots in the country through their spy agencies and propaganda apparatus. London, in particular, hosts several anti-Iranian networks, including Iran International, Manoto, and BBC Persian. The U.S. is pushing for the removal of Iran from the UN Commission on the Status of Women following trumped-up claims by foreign media that attributed the killing of women to the Iranian government during the recent unrest in the country. They claim that they are acting in defense of women's rights, but they are in fact violating those rights and preventing women from raising their issues through pushing for the removal of Iran from the UN Commission. The 54-member UN Economic and Social Council is expected to vote on December 14th whether to oust Iran from the commission or not.
Anti-Iran media networks are reporting a three-day strike by Iranian shopkeepers as part of recent unrest in the country. But in Tehran, shops were open today and people were busy shopping, as our correspondent reports.
According to foreign-based news channels, a three-day strike was supposed to sweep across the country from Monday through Wednesday. But a quick walk around the streets of Tehran, especially its Grand Bazaar, shows the shops are all open and people are busy shopping for their own needs. There are videos circulating on social media purporting to show some shops in Tehran's Grand Bazaar closed. People say, however, that these shopkeepers have closed their shops in fear of vandalism. In some cases, rioters have rendered shopkeepers unable to open their shops by putting glues on their locks. Also, there is news that unknown gunmen have opened fire on some trucks whose drivers were not willing to stop working during the three-day strike. Meanwhile, Iranian Judiciary Chief Ghulam Hossein Mohsen-Ejei has warned that those who threaten or force sellers close their shops and join the strike will be identified and prosecuted.
Look around here. All shops are open. Thank God people are doing their daily shopping. This is a message to London-based media outlets. We are Iranians, we love our country, and we have unity. What you broadcast on your TV channels are mere lies.
Before coming to the Grand Bazaar for shopping, I had been told that there might be a strike. But as I have walked around the streets, I see no sign of a strike here. I think those who call for strikes are only making fun of themselves because a majority of people do not care about them.
The country has been gripped by riots for 10 weeks now, with the unrest claiming the lives of civilians and security forces.
The Islamic Republic says foreign media outlets are overstating what's going on in Iran to fan the flames of unrest. Officials are now calling on rioters to calm down, warning them against playing into the hands of Iran's enemies. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
A U.S. judge has dismissed a lawsuit against Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman over the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. A federal judge in Washington said the suit submitted by Khashoggi's widow made a strong argument that Prince was behind the murder. However, he said he had no power to reject the U.S. government's position that the Prince Mohammed has immunity in U.S. courts as a foreign leader. Khashoggi was murdered in Turkey in 2018 after he went to the Saudi consulate in Istanbul to get his marriage certificate. U.S. intelligence reports say Mohammed bin Salman had approved the operation against Khashoggi, but Saudi officials have denied the reports. The U.S. has opposed the move by Qatar-based Al Jazeera News Network to submit the case of the slain Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh to the International Criminal Court. The State Department says the ICC should focus on its core mission, which is serving as a court of last resort in punishing and deterring atrocious crimes. Al Jazeera says there had been complete cover-up by Israel over Abu Akleh's killing. It says based on its rulings, the court must identify those directly involved in her murder. The network says it has new evidence challenging the regime's claim that the journalist was accidentally killed by crossfire. Abu Akleh was shot on May 11th while covering an Israeli raid on the Jenin refugee camp. Regime has defied calls for an investigation. Israel says it will not cooperate with any external probe into her death. A new development in the trial of pro-Palestine British priest Reverend Stephen Sizer over alleged anti-Semitism charges. Saya Puraza has your details.
A Church of England disciplinary tribunal for this man, Reverend Stephen Sizer, one of the leading figures in the debunking of Christian Zionism. The purpose of the tribunal: to hear 11 anti-Semitism accusations against him. His main accuser, the Board of Deputies of British Jews. The accusations against him, sharing a platform with Holocaust deniers while attending peace conferences in the Middle East, and sharing on social media articles containing anti-Semitic conspiracy theories from other websites. The 68-year-old priest declined to comment after the hearing, but people close to him say he's been crucified for criticizing Israel.
Those Jews like me and many others who worked with Dr. Sizer for many years know for sure that he's the last person on this earth you could call an anti-Semite or racist. He is the kindest, very careful person, and he's anything but the opposite of anti-Semite. He is against what Israel is doing, so am I. And so are many Jews in this country and across the world.
The problem arises from the controversial International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance's definition of anti-Semitism, which conflates criticism of Israel with hatred of Jews.
Now is the time the Church of England really needs to stop on the IHRA. It can't come out and say they have reservations with the IHRA and then still use the same definition. This makes no sense in any shape or form. And needs to be addressed seriously. It's basically like saying We agree that this is wrong, but we're still going to go ahead with it because don't really care whether it offends Muslims or whether it upsets Muslims.
Today's hearing cleared the Reverend of 7 of the 11 allegations against him.
A final hearing is scheduled for next month. People close to Stephen Sizer say that this whole thing was a witch hunt that has taken its toll on the Reverend, on his family, and the people who support him and the Palestinian cause. Said Four is up, London.
And our EU finance minister has expressed frustration with Hungary over blocking billions of euros in financial aid for Ukraine. Hungary is at odds with Brussels over claims that Budapest is flouting the bloc's rule of law. Jerome Hughes reports from the EU headquarters in Brussels.
EU leaders are furious with Hungary for blocking an 18 billion euro financial aid package for Ukraine, the first tranche of which is due to be released to Kiev next month. Finance ministers from the 27-nation bloc came together on Tuesday to try and resolve the impasse, but the meeting ended in failure.
Ukraine is a country at war. It desperately needs our support, and we just cannot allow one member state delay and derail this EU financial support.
This debacle follows a European Commission proposal last week to freeze 7.5 billion euro in funding to Hungary from the EU budget amid claims that Budapest is not meeting the bloc's rule of law standards. Aside from Ukraine, EU finance ministers have major problems closer to home. The energy crisis in the EU, resulting from sanctions against Russia, is getting worse by the day. The European Commission warns of economic disaster if EU nations continue to subsidize high energy costs in an ad hoc emergency fashion.
That is why we encourage member states to improve the targeting of this measure, and we have recommended replacing broad-based priced measure with a cost-efficient two-tier energy pricing system.
Out of control, energy prices are making the cost of living crisis in the EU unbearable for households and businesses. Eurozone inflation is at 10%. The European Central Bank is aggressively increasing interest rates to try and tackle the problem. Economists warn forcing inflation down too quickly can also be dangerous.
Of course, if you have a persistent drop in prices, people might think, well, I'm not going to buy now. I'm not going to spend now because prices will come down. So I'm going to stay with my money in the pockets and wait for later. And of course, you don't have economic activity.
Croatia will become the 20th member of the Eurozone next month. EU finance ministers say Zagreb will be able to enjoy all the benefits. However, the euro has a troubled history, and so it's clear Croatia will also be exposed to potential risks during these incredibly uncertain economic times. Jerome Hughes, the EU Finance Minister's meeting, Brussels.
A new report presented to the Canadian Parliament says that the government has wasted billions of dollars of unused COVID vaccines and pandemic aid to ineligible people. Canadian Auditor General Karen Hogan says more than 27 billion Canadian dollars of overpayments should be investigated. She said Ottawa mainly relied on information provided by applicants and limited controls in order to expedite payments. Hogan said the government overbought vaccine doses and over 13 million of them were spoiled according to the audit. Most of the remaining stockpile is expected to expire by the end of this year. U.S. stocks have tumbled again as leading bank executives express worries about a possible recession next year, adding to investor unease. The Dow Jones Industrial Average finished down 1%. The broad-based S&P 500 shed 1.4%, while the tech-rich NASDAQ Composite dropped 2%. That's after J.P. Morgan Chase said there is a chance for a mild hard-to-hard recession next year. Goldman Sachs has also offered a similar forecast. Losses add to the toll this week after major indices also fell more than 1% on worries that the Federal Reserve's policy to counter inflation will be prolonged. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres slams the multinational corporations for turning the world's ecosystems into playthings of profit.
Ecosystems have become playthings of profit. With our bottomless appetite for unchecked and unequal economic growth, humanity has become a weapon of mass extinction. We are treating nature like a toilet, and ultimately, we are committing suicide by proxy.
Guterres also warned that failure to correct course will lead to catastrophic results. He made the remarks in a speech ahead of biodiversity talks in Montreal. Nearly 200 countries have gathered for the UN Biodiversity Conference, which is set to address environmental and climate issues.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
According to the most recent statistics, there are now 4,760 Palestinian political prisoners in the Zionist regime's jails, with the Zionist regime enjoying huge support from the U.S. and the European Union. It faces no consequences for the abuse of prisoners. Apart from issuing timid statements of concern, the powerful allow the Zionist regime's cruelty to go unchallenged. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, "Adjusting to reality outside the confines of an Israeli regime prison is not easy." Alian Al-Amour has found out that the sense of freedom I have now is strange, the 43-year-old said, adding, "When I walk, I find it hard to believe I can move without anyone stopping me." On the day after his release in September, Alian met his fiancée, Dina, for the first time. The couple got engaged while Alian was in prison, but Dina was never able to visit him. Alian and Dina married within a few weeks of their first meeting. It was an important step toward ensuring that Alian can rebuild his life. The horrors he encountered behind bars cannot be erased from his memory. His long period of detention began in September 2006. Alian was at home in Al-Fukhari near the Gaza city of Khan Yunus when Israeli regime troops invaded the area and arrested him. He was quickly brought to Ashkelon prison inside the occupied territories, where he was kept for 35 days. During that period, he was held underground and was repeatedly beaten and threatened by his Israeli interrogators. Alian believes that his interrogators wanted to coerce him into confessing to something he had not done. Over the next 3 years, Alian was brought to court on numerous occasions. He noted, "The bus used to transport him looked good on the outside, but inside there were iron bars, handcuffs, and armed troops." Although the trip to court should have been short, the Zionist regime authorities would often keep Alian handcuffed inside the bus for long periods. It was not unusual for Alian to be held in the bus for 3 full days as the drivers transported him and other Palestinians between the court and various prisons. 3 years after his trial began, Alian, who had worked in the Palestinian Authority security forces, was sentenced to a lengthy jail term
over allegations that he was involved in resistance activities. He spent a total of 16 years behind bars, mostly in Ramon prison. Throughout his time in jail, Alian was held in harsh conditions. As he was in reasonably good health, Alian was arguably a little more fortunate than other prisoners. He became increasingly conscious of how the conditions exacerbated the health problems of prisoners who were unwell. Alian wanted to help those with medical issues, yet for most of the time, all he was able to do was communicate with them remotely, via lawyers or by sending verbal messages when he met other prisoners on buses, heading to and from court and offer some moral support. That changed in 2019. Early that year, he submitted a request to join a group of prisoners who work in Ramal Prison Clinic. His request was accepted by the authorities. Initially, he was excited by how he had an opportunity to do what he wanted. His excitement turned to shock as soon as he saw the cruelty inflicted on Palestinian patients in Ramel. He said, "It was like a slaughterhouse. I will never forget the sight of patients on my first day there. Their hands were cuffed to the beds. Their faces looked sad and exhausted. And I could see from thin bodies how severely ill they were. There was no doubt that the hospital was not taking care of them." Along with a few other prisoners, Alian assisted patients who required help to eat and take medicine or who had mobility issues. At times, he would raise patients' complaints with lawyers or with the clinic's administration. A number of patients Alian met in Ramel had cancer. The services offered to cancer patients were, he noted, completely inadequate. For chemotherapy and other essential treatments, cancer patients were transferred to hospitals that were larger. Once a week, guards at the Rommel Clinic would carry out an inspection generally at night time. During it, patients were moved to a yard for a number of hours, no matter what the weather was like. Prisoners with medical needs frequently face an ordeal. The Israeli regime authorities can stall on processing prisoners' applications for hospital treatment. It is not uncommon, according to Alian, for 18 months or 2 years to elapse between an application for such treatment and a final decision. Sometimes the authorities reject requests. He said, "There are hundreds of prisoners with health problems, but they are afraid of the Zionist hospitals because of the deliberate negligence. I haven't seen a patient get better in the hospital. The patients only leave in coffins. It is very sad." The three of Ramle's patients died in the few years that Alian worked in the clinic. Among them was Bassam Al-Say, 46, from Nablus, in the occupied West Bank. Al-Say had leukemia and died in September 2019. Bassam used to say, "I want to go back to Gaza with you and eat fish on the beach," Alian said. That was in the last few days of his life. I held back my tears and told him, "It would be wonderful if we could go to the beach in Gaza together." As well as visiting patients in Ramle Clinic, Alian reached out to some other prisoners who were ill. One of them, Sami Al-Amur, was a relative from Deir al-Balah in Gaza. Alian would send verbal messages to Sami via other prisoners. Last year, doctors recommended that Sami should have surgery for blocked arteries. But rather than being taken to hospital, Sami was kept in prison. Alian argued that keeping Sami in prison was tantamount to a death sentence. Alian added, "They knew how critical his condition was. Sami died in Zionist regime custody during November last year. He was only 39. The horrors which Alian al-Amour encountered have been witnessed by so many others. Meanwhile, Palestinian Wafa News Agency reported Mohammad Masrawa, 25, from Tulkarm, lost sight in his right eye after Israeli regime occupation troops assaulted him during his arrest at his family's house on January 20 of this year. They said the prisoners and ex-prisoners affairs condition had reported this news. It said in a statement that Israeli regime troops assaulted Masrawa, currently in Israeli regime custody, with the rifle butts on his head and forehead, which caused a severe injury to the forehead that led to losing vision in his right eye. It said Masrawa was supposed to undergo an operation on his eye this month, but that the Zionist regime prison services cancelled the operation on the pretext that he is going to finish his sentence in April of next year, after serving a year and a half in prison for resisting the occupation. The commission said Masrawa suffers from severe stomach pains and that he was given medication for a short period before the prison clinic stopped it without any reason. Masrawa is a former prisoner who spent 20 months in the Zionist regime prisons.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm your host, Zainab. And today in our studio, we have with us Islamic researcher and educationalist, Dr. Ali Alavi. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Thank you very much for inviting me to your show.
We have been discussing about self-confidence, mm-hmm. and we discussed a lot about it. And now I would want to know about some signs that tell us a child has lowered self-confidence. Mm-hmm. Because we talked about the signs which show us that your child has good self-confidence. Now I want you to tell us the signs that show your child has lowered self-confidence.
Definitely. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. I just want to remind the respected listeners about the signs of kids or children who have a good self-confidence, and they are known as self-confident people. They are, as we said earlier, they are independent in their actions and activities, and also they act maturely in their actions. They are honored of, and they are proud of whatever they are doing, and actually they talk about their outcomes and, let's say, consequences very openly. And they accept the failure that they have. If you remember, we said that these are the signs that it shows that our kid is self-confident. And he responsively accepts his failures. The next is that he has the courage of entering in new arenas and challenges and accepts the risk the risks of any challenge. And the next was that in some occasions, he has this ability and capability to help others.
Yeah.
So these signs show that our kid is self-confident. So definitely there must be something in the other side, that is what is in opposite.
Yeah.
So what are the signs that tells us, okay, that this kid and this girl, this son of us, is poor in self-confidence?
Yeah.
So one, the first thing that I can refer to is that unlike the other one, that he actually welcomes all risks and challenges, he doesn't welcome any challenges and any new opportunities,
yeah.
You see? This child actually feels that no one loves him and actually no one wants him. Do you remember, I think,
feeling
one of the discussions?
Insecurity.
Yeah,
okay.
Feeling of insecurity that we had it earlier, that we said that these are the reasons that actually he understands that he is not being loved anymore by somebody.
All right.
Look, sometimes a word of mother or father that I hate you, it's very easy to be uttered, but it has a bad effect on the personality of the kid.
All right.
Look, this kid cannot digest it, at least at that time, though they are too smart, but they think that everything is direct and there is no lie in between, see? Or there is at least no pretension, or there is no conspiracy that we parents usually have. So when you tell them that I hate you, he really takes it for himself or herself.
He thinks you really hate him.
Definitely. So when you tell them that they feel that no one loves them anymore or wants them. The next, if you have seen a kid with this circumstance that he thinks that no one is loving him or her, it means that his self-confidence has been damaged somewhere. We have to try to treat and cure it.
Yeah. So we will discuss more signs after a short break. Dear listeners,
sure.
Stay tuned with us.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm with Dr. Ali Alavi, and we are talking about self-confidence. Dr. Alavi, you have been helping us to know about the signs that show that our children have got lowered self-confidence.
Yeah. We have been talking about two or three signs of those who lack self-confidence. One is that they are not welcoming any opportunities or challenges. Second, they think that no one loves them and wants them. Third, is the time to say that they try to blame others for their own mistakes. You see? So we said that in the opposite side. Those who have enough self-confidence, they actually accept their failures responsibly. But with this subject, we see that they try to actually blame others for their own mistakes, and they
All right.
are not going to accept their failures. The next factor or the next element that tells us that this kid or this subject is afflicted with a lack of self-confidence is that they are unable to cope with normal levels or with any issue very smoothly. So they find everything quite difficult. In order to, for example, in case you ask them to do something, they might count too many problems and too many difficulties on the way to perform it.
Okay.
So it seems that, okay, he is actually, he feels that he is not the person to cope with this
he
problem.
He feels like, you'll feel with his statements, he knows he's not capable of, or he
at
has
least,
this feeling of his capability.
At least, yeah, it has been, he tries to persuade himself that he is not capable of doing it, though he has this capability to perform it. And it has some actually treatment in order to tell them that, no, you are capable enough to perform, to act, and to do this.
Mm-hmm.
So even with some simple word, we can actually revive this sense of capability in the subject. The next sign that actually we can find in such subjects is that they have a sort of, let's say, a negative self-talk about their own selves. If you remember, we said in the factors that leads to the weakening the self-confidence, we said that when they are compared with others.
Yeah.
You see, now they have heard too much comparison, and now they just say, okay, I'm not the one that can do it. You see, I'm not suitable for this case. They say lots of negative
they
self-talk.
They fail before making any efforts.
Definitely. They find, I mean, there's failure from the very beginning, you
yeah.
see. So what's the reason? The reason is due to that bad comparisons that have been made earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And even with the same case that you actually referred to, the question of the person or the brother or sister who sent the question to this show.
Yeah.
The person, such a person always is in fear of a failure. Or he or she is always in the fear or embarrassment
mm-hmm.
of an action that might come to him or her.
Mm-hmm.
And they have, again, if you see that your kid or child is not able to make a good friendship with others, it means that there is something wrong there. So what's wrong? Because, I mean, kids in this age, or in, let's say in the ages that we are talking about, let's say the ages of 9 and 10 and over, they have to naturally have this power to find good friends.
Yeah.
But we see that they are not able to make it. It means that there is something wrong with them because they feel humiliated and they feel that no one, they deserve to be the friend of no one.
Mm-hmm.
You see, that's the problem that they are always with. The next element or the next sign that we can see in this series, or in this subject, is that their interest and motivation for doing everything is lower than the kids in the same age. For example, if you define a very good, let's say, occasion or even event for them that is usually loved by kids of the same age,
yeah,
it seems that they are not that interested to go. They prefer to stay at home and actually do nothing.
Make excuses
not to yeah. attend that events.
Well, we'll discuss more on that after a short break, dear listeners. Stay tuned with us.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
The Prophet صلى الله عليه وآله وسلم said, Honor your children and teach them good manners.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي
Welcome back. You're listening to The Islamic Upbringing. I'm with Dr. Ali Alavi, and we're talking about self-confidence. Dr. Alavi is helping us to know about the signs that show that your child has a lower self-confidence. Yes, Dr. Alavi.
Yeah. The next sign that we can find in the kids or children of, in some kids or children who are, let's say, afflicted with low self-confidence is that they try not to accept the definitions or, let's say, descriptions that are being done about themselves, about them. For example, if their mother or father actually describe them in a good way, they try not to accept it and they say these are quite nonsense because I know that I'm not that, let's say, talented and they are just going to make me happy, they say these things. So it means that it has been ruined from somewhere, this ability has been destroyed somewhere, and I don't know whether from the parents or the guardians or the teachers at school or anywhere else,
mm-hmm.
but this time he cannot accept himself a good, let's say.
All your praises are in vain, whatever
yeah.
the praises you're making about your child.
He or she thinks that he or she does not deserve these kind of praises and definitions or, let's say, descriptions that are being made.
Or maybe he feels like they're lying.
Yeah, they're lying for him, yeah, definitely. And usually, even for some, that, for example, human beings usually, I mean, we also as human beings, usually got happy when we are praised, you see.
Yeah.
Though it's also a good another illness that has to be cured in its own place.
Well, I'm a female, and I know we have this illness very, very deeply.
Yeah. So yeah, it is good to some extent.
You said yeah with the emphasis.
No. I didn't mean that. Being praised is not something that usually people get happy when they are praised, right?
Yeah.
But we have to be careful. always this sense of being praised, in case everything actually exceeds its borders and limits, it would be problems.
Are you trying to say that praise is good, but when praise becomes flattering, it is problematic?
Problematic, and it will cause problems. But these actually group of subjects, they are usually reject such praises, and they think that whatever has been said or told about them are not real, and they feel a sort of anxiety and let's say stress when they are praised. So they try to reject and not accept all these praises about themselves. But one more point, and finalizing my discussion. Inshallah, we shall move to the ways in, to strengthen this self-confidence in our kids in our upcoming session.
I'm waiting for that.
Yeah. We want to tell the respected parents and the respected audience of this show that self-confidence does not happen overnight and cannot be revived again overnight.
Wow.
Yeah. So it means that it has, a series of events had happened already that led to lack of self-confidence in one. Mm-hmm. And series of other actions have happened by some, let's say, thinkers that led to the, a good self-confidence of the other.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to be careful in order to, we first need to know what elements actually lead us towards this and what elements lead us toward that.
Mm-hmm.
So these are the issues that we have to know as parents and audience, as parents and the guardians of our kids.
Mm-hmm.
Inshallah, in our upcoming session, we shall focus on some methods and ways in order to strengthen their self-confidence.
Thank you, Dr. Alavi, for being with us with such great information.
Dear
listeners, we so far talked about the self-confidence in children, what are the signs that show highest level of self-confidence, what are the signs that show lowered self-confidence, and now we'll be moving towards the ways to strengthen and to boost this self-confidence, which is very, very necessary. So stay tuned with us until another session. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Experts in the U.S. have warned that they are deeply concerned that the Biden administration is minimizing COVID at a time when it needs to be redoubling its efforts to ensure funding and resources to prevent another surge. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of Common Dreams wrote, refuting President Joe Biden's recent claim that the pandemic is over, a group of physicians, epidemiologists, and other experts warned in an open letter published recently that COVID-19 remains a deadly and disabling threat, including in the United States of America, which is ill-prepared for a possible winter surge fueled by the emergence of new Omicron strains. We know from our clinical and research experience that the pandemic is far from over, and that national efforts to secure the health and well-being of the American public are far from complete, the scholars wrote in the esteemed British Medical Journal, adding, "We are deeply concerned that the Biden administration is minimizing COVID at a time when it needs to be redoubling its efforts to ensure funding and resources to prevent another surge. The U.S. hasn't put in the effort needed to move into a new phase with confidence," states the letter, adding, "Booster coverage even among older Americans is abysmal. With only half of vaccinated adults having received a booster, this places the U.S. 73rd globally for booster coverage. Fewer than 6% of immunocompromised Americans, a group that accounted for nearly 1 in 5 hospital admissions during the BA2 surge, have received Evalshet, a therapy to help prevent COVID-19. To make matters worse, just 4% of eligible Americans have so far received the new bivalent booster tailored to protect against the dominant subvariant. Recent polling found that over half of fully vaccinated adults don't know they are eligible for the shot, and less than 1/3 say they plan to get their fourth vaccine dose as soon as possible. Rampant right-wing anti-science campaigns have played a significant role, to be sure, but so too has the nation's for-profit healthcare model, as well as efforts to normalize the ongoing dangers posed by the continuously mutating coronavirus. Soon after Biden downplayed the pandemic in his 60 Minutes interview, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, announced that masking will no longer be universally required in healthcare facilities and nursing homes. If Biden's recent comment indicates that the administration is positioned to pull back further pandemic mitigation, the public health experts warned recently, the U.S. will be preparing for a major storm without even an umbrella in hand. They wrote, "Pandemics do not end with a flip of a switch," adding, "Despite the widespread belief that the pandemic is over, death and disruption continue. As Americans embrace what McKinsey and Company has called individual endemicity, in which people let their risk tolerance dictate the preventive measures they take, transmission rates remain at dangerous levels in nearly every county of the U.S. throughout the summer. The U.S. recorded approximately 3,000 deaths per week, at least the equivalent of a 9/11's worth of deaths each week, and often more. The Delta and Omicron surges took 350,000 American lives in 7 months, almost 7 times as many fatalities as claimed by the most severe flu season in years. In early September 2022, COVID-19 was the second leading cause of death in the United States, claiming more lives than stroke and common cancers. Beyond its outsized death toll, COVID-19 is leaving many Americans in diminished health and with less economic security. More than 7% of Americans report experiencing protracted post-COVID symptoms. Recent estimates suggest long COVID has forced at least 500,000 people out of the workplace. The continuing impact of the pandemic is particularly devastating given its unequal burden on communities of color and socioeconomically vulnerable populations. who are less likely to have private insurance to cover prevention, testing, and treatment costs. The U.S. is in a different position than it was when the pandemic first emerged, thanks to the increased availability of vaccines, tests, and treatments made possible by robust funding. But the money underpinning the free provision of those medical tools is rapidly disappearing, leading to what Adam Gaffney, an assistant professor of medicine at Harvard University and pulmonary and intensive care unit doctor, calls the rationing of COVID care by ability to pay. While Biden has repeatedly asked Congress to authorize billions of dollars in additional spending to address COVID-19 and monkeypox, including resources that would be directed toward international efforts, lawmakers led by Senator and the Republicans have refused for months to allocate new money. The president's premature assertion about the end of the pandemic, meanwhile, has only bolstered right-wing demands for austerity, and the continuing resolution passed recently excluded funding for both infectious disease outbreaks. Earlier this year, the White House sounded the alarm about the potential coronavirus surge in the coming month that could infect up to 100 million people nationwide, resulting in a million hospitalizations and nearly 200,000 additional deaths in a worst-case scenario. People in the U.S., already home to more than 1 million of the world's COVID-19 deaths, have died at a significantly higher rate than their counterparts in other wealthy nations. For individual health care, paid sick leave, and other life-saving rights were won decades ago. Notably, average life expectancy in the U.S. has declined substantially over the past 2 years. The experts wrote, "We need a full court press this fall to reverse these trends and reach more of the public with boosters and antivirals." Echoing recommendations made recently by the People's CDC, the letter continues, "The U.S. must make smart investments in the future of our country's response. We need to continue prioritizing tests, masks, treatments, and ventilation. Failing to produce these resources and make them widely accessible will effectively waste the benefits of the scientific advances we have made thus far. Inadequate funding may also slow or stop our progress towards developing new and more protective nasal and pan-coronavirus vaccines and therapies." Globally, the pandemic has caused more than 15 million deaths. People in low-income countries have been deprived of equal access to life-saving COVID-19 medical tools, leaving billions of people in Africa and other parts of the global south completely unprotected. The Lancet's COVID-19 Commission declared last month that widespread failures during the COVID-19 pandemic at multiple levels worldwide have led to millions of preventable deaths and a reversal in progress towards sustainable development for many countries. Starkly unequal access to medicines, fueled by high-income nations, gobbling up a disproportionate shares of jobs and therapeutics, and pharmaceutical corporations refusing to share knowledge and technology, has contributed massively to avoidable suffering. It also enables the coronavirus to continue circulating and mutating, increasing the likelihood of a vaccine-resistant variant emerging. Lancet, in its